Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In past years, Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference has provided a tantalizing glimpse into the tech company's future. And there was plenty of buzz leading up to this year's event, which kicked off yesterday in San Francisco. Joining us to talk about that by phone from Colorado is Jeff Gamet. He is managing editor at the Mac Observer. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It seems a lot of this year's conference has been about uniting Apple and the ecosystem, so to speak. For example, the iHome and new potential Mac OS operating system. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The new HomeKit features. That looks like a really great foundation for Apple moving forward, because it gives them the ability to give us a unified control system for all the features in our smart homes, whether that might be Hue light bulbs or Wemo smart switches or garage door openers that can tell when we're close enough to them so that they can just open automatically. And for users, that gives them a way to be able to control all these things from a single point, as opposed to having to do that jumping between apps routine that we all have to do right now. So we get this really great convenience thing out of it, but what Apple really gets is the beginnings of control over everything that happens in our homes. So they can become ubiquitous system management for all of those things that we want to automate.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jeff Gamet. He's managing editor at the Mac Observer, and we're talking about Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Who goes to these events usually when they talk about developers? Is it outside developers or is it Apple's developers from around the world? How does that work?
The way it works is you get developers, I'll call them the third-party developers.
Okay.
So these are the other companies that are making applications and hardware that work with Apple's products. You will also, though, have a lot of Apple's own engineers there, because those are the people that are actually putting on the sessions. So for a developer, this is a very unique once-a-year opportunity to be able to get one-on-one FaceTime with the people that are writing and designing all of the things that they're trying to hook into. So they can learn more about Apple's roadmap moving forward, and that's something that we rarely get to see. And then they also get to talk with the people that are making all the pieces that they want to use, so they can get answers to questions that are causing them all kinds of headaches and frustration. Like maybe a developer is working on an application for some new type of game, and they can't figure out why this one part simply won't work. Well, maybe they can go talk to the people that are working on Apple's display technology and get the answer they need so they can fix their game and get it on the market.
And Apple's engineers will talk with them about that.
Oh, yes. They will definitely talk with them about things like that. It's a very open environment for the developers and for Apple, because everything's happening under the umbrella of non-disclosure agreements. So it's understood that everything that's said past the keynote event that happened yesterday, it's just among friends, so to speak. It's all private, and it stays that way until the official launches of these products.
Apple CEO Tim Cook's keynote speech focused quite a bit on numbers and how many people actually use Apple's operating OS X system. Why was this an important point to hit on?
It's always an important point for Apple and for Microsoft and for Google as well, because they like to remind the developers just how big their potential audience or market is. And then there's the posturing that goes along with it to let the public and investors know just how successful their products are. In Apple's case, I think that there may also be a little bit of holdover from the old days when Apple was referred to as beleaguered and the company that was about to go under. And now they can hold up as a badge of honor how many Mac users and iPhone users they have and how quickly people are adopting new versions of their operating systems. It wasn't really that long ago when people were concerned about what would happen to Apple. And now it's more of a concern about how much of the market Apple's really going to control.
And to a certain degree, how long is my iPhone 4 going to work for me with these new developments?
Oh, that's a really great question, and I have bad news for you.
I actually have a 4S, but for those who have a 4, listen up.
Okay, so you're fine with your 4S.
Yes.
iOS 8, which comes out this fall, will work on an iPhone 4S or newer. The iPhone 4 and older will not be supported. And on one hand, that's really sad, but on the other hand, there aren't that many companies that will support devices as far back as Apple does with iOS. So that's kind of a cool thing there. But yeah, if you have an iPhone 4 and you want to play with iOS 8, start saving your pennies. It's going to be time to get a new iPhone.
So is that probably what some might categorize as a big disappointment in the reveal in San Francisco right now with Apple, or are there others?
As far as big disappointments go, the big disappointment that people are talking about is Apple didn't announce new hardware. And in my mind, that's more of a contrived disappointment in that Apple had so many big announcements that they made yesterday that was plenty to fill up the whole keynote. Plus, Worldwide Developer Conference keynotes are typically not the place where Apple makes big hardware announcements. There have been exceptions, but they're very few and far between. So I was not expecting any hardware announcements yesterday. Have there been any? I would have been very surprised. What I'm expecting is that over the next few weeks, we will start to get other product announcements coming out of Apple. And they laid a really great groundwork yesterday for those announcements to take place. A perfect example is HealthKit. And HealthKit is the whole health management and fitness tracking platform that Apple has developed. Yesterday, what they showed off was just a unified interface. So you can take any device that will be HealthKit compatible. And the device they showed off was the Nike Fuel Band. But of course, there will be other devices. And it wouldn't surprise me to see companies like Fitbit add support for HealthKit very quickly, simply because when you have a system like that, you want to jump on board. With that in place, Apple has now given us the framework for whatever it is that they're going to do in wearable technology. So we have all the rumors about iWatch and talk about how iWatch will be this all-in-one magical health and fitness tracker. Well, now it's going to be a lot easier to do that because all the software that Apple needs to make that happen, they just announced it.
What else did they announce?
Well, they also gave us HomeKit, which we've already talked about. They did a really big thing for developers and something that I'm very excited about, which is they added a feature called extensibility to iOS 8. And what that means is that a developer can now get at data from other applications on the iPhone and iPad. That's something that they really haven't been able to do before now because Apple uses a feature called sandboxing for security, and it just locks each little app and all its data away in its own private little place. Well, they're opening up a conduit so that you can get that data back and forth between applications, and you can take it a step farther and share features between applications. The demonstration that Apple showed for this feature was using their own Photos application to then use a artistic filter from an application called Waterlog and turn a photograph into something that looked like a watercolor painting without ever having to switch applications. This to me is huge because it takes away the parts that hobbled iOS in the past, and we'll be able to do things like use applications that store all of our passwords and then have those hook into whatever web browser we want to use and automatically fill in passwords when we do logins. A perfect application or example of that would be 1Password. And that's an application that's available on iOS and OS X, and it will become substantially more useful. And there's applications that will automatically fill in words for you and expand abbreviations like Text Expander. And that's been a very limited tool so far on iOS. But come this fall, that will be something that can suddenly work across all applications.
Why did they decide to change it? Why did they, break down the sandbox?
It was time. Well, it's been time.
I know. People have complained about it for a long time.
You know, maybe they just got tired of listening to us whine.
Okay.
No, I think what it really comes down to is, even though Apple is a very nimble company, there are times when they will act very slowly and very methodically. And with something like this, I think it really came down to they wanted to make sure that they weren't opening up dangerous security holes in the operating system. That's a big issue just across the board. And people are really worried and aware all the time now about the potential for their iPhone or their Samsung Galaxy phone to get hacked. And if you want to keep your customers trusting you, you need to make sure that you're giving them safe tools. And I think that played a big role in why Apple waited to give us this extensibility.
So I respect that. So does that mean that it's less secure now, or that they've taken the time to make sure it won't be less secure?
We'll know this fall.
Okay.
They've taken steps to make it more secure. All that information that goes between applications is going to go through a sandboxed area as well.
Okay.
So
that
there will be a security management system in there. And when we get to see this in action, then we'll know how well it really works.
Well, maybe we'll talk again in the fall then, and we can see what clicks and what doesn't.
I think that sounds great.
All right. Jeff Gamet, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Jeff Gamet, he's managing editor at Mac Observer. Coming up, we continue with All Sides Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Kids these days, they can work an iPad practically from birth. In fact, app developers have gone so far as to give us a Rattle app. Joining us now to talk about that and more is the editor of Children's Technology Review, Warren Buchleitner. Welcome back to the show, Warren.
Nice to be with you, Ann.
All right, so TAP was just recently released. It's described as a digital rattle for babies and parents. I'm not sure what the parents have to do with it, but what does it do?
Well, I think you're talking about Bubble. Is it Bubble Tap?
Maybe it's Bubble Tap. Okay.
Yeah. So it's Bubble. There's two apps, actually. One is Bubble Tap and Bubble Draw, and it's B-U-B-L, and it's from Germany. It's sort of like interactive art. I like Draw better than the Tap one, although you can see what they both are, but it turns your screen into this musical finger paint kind of place, and once you get started, you just can't stop. So it's very high in child control, which means that a very young child can use it as well as a senior citizen. So it's really cool. But once you make a scribble, you touch it again, and it comes to life with music. So there's this musical art connection.
What's the music? Where does it come from?
The music, there's three styles. There's like an island style and a hip-hop style. It's the thing about it is it's related to your motion. It's kind of hard to describe. This is one of those apps where you're like, why are we doing a radio show? We really need to show this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's so visually and whatever. But take my word for it. It's 99 cents well spent.
It's sort of like, sounds like to me, finger painting with sound.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. And but I'd go for Draw.
Okay.
So it's Bubble Draw. That's the name of the app. I'm less sold on the idea of the one for babies because they're kind of marketing it directly to your babies. And I think I still think, you know, there's sort of analog things that work better.
You mean things that they can hold?
Yeah, like, you know, a cat or a stuffed animal or, you know, that kind of thing.
So the age range for Draw, though, very young to very old.
Yeah, it's really all ages, and that's what's the best thing about it. It's you can't fail, and so there's something there for all of us.
There is also an iPad case available on their website. It's designed for kids. It has a handle and stuff. Is that just a gimmick, or do you think that's really helpful?
iPad cases are extremely helpful. I use one called from Grip Case USA that is has these handles that let you hang your iPad. I use it on an iPad Mini because the Mini is so small. It just makes it, I actually use it for myself, but it also offers that layer of protection. And I like the ones that are foam-based rather than sort of the silicone, more rubbery ones. The other thing is that make sure it doesn't block your ports. Because there have been so many versions of iPads that are different thicknesses, sometimes you get these cases, you wedge your device in, and then you got to use it, you know, charging it or putting it in a cradle. And that can be a huge pain. And so iPad cases have their double-edged sword.
You suggested we talk about is it Sago Mini Space Explorer?
Yeah. A studio called Sago. They're from Canada. It's S-A-G-O, S-A-G-O. I don't know where they get their names, but they...
I've given up,
Yeah, this studio was acquired by Toca Boca, and Toca Boca is becoming sort of the Beatles of the kids' app space. Sago specializes on apps for younger children. What's beautiful about this app is that this one's called Sago Mini Space Explorer. It's the third or fourth in the series, and you can just touch anywhere on the screen, and this little dog flies around and meets friends, and there's musical relationships to discover and all sorts of other ideas that children can just accidentally discover. And it's very playful and high in child control. So it meets all of our criteria.
Tell us again what you mean by child control.
Child control is where you touch and something happens versus some apps you start up and it's just got a lot of music or, it's incredible how complicated some of these apps have become. I'm looking for, you know, the thing I like about that Bubble Draw is it starts with a blank white screen and no background music, and it says it's your turn. So I use the word crisp sometimes. You know, it's not laggy.
Mm-hmm.
These are really critical attributes for anyone who's designing an experience for young children, because children need control, as do adults.
How do you, when you're testing these, are you testing them with children? And who are the lucky little devils?
They're lucky little devils or anyone I can get, be around. Friends, children, or whatever. But I have a center in our library called MediaTek, and it's a public center where anyone can walk in. So every Friday, I have a testing session, and I just bring in, you know, I test video games and all kinds of things. So I use that as a place where I can get a grounding in reality. I wish I could test every app, but it's just not possible. There's so many apps these days.
With the Sago Mini Explorer, it's not just that it pops up and you guide the little dog through space. There's a storyline, or is it just random?
It's a little bit more of a random thing, actually, in that you could argue you can make up your own story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like a sandbox. And so I could easily see a child self-narrating a story where I'm going to fly over and see my friend on the moon, and then, you know, and they'll start. It's the kind of thing that'd be a really nice evening kind of app where you want to let your child wind down a little bit, because they might want to go see things, and because they control it, you know, they can do predictable things. And these are the kind of experiences that you can use in a lot of different ways.
So then there's Toca Town, and you mentioned Toca Boca. We
have to talk about Toca Town.
Yeah.
This is the big app. It's only 3 days old. I think it's one of Toca Boca's best apps, and that's saying a lot, because they did Toca Hair, the Toca Hair Salon.
Uh-huh.
They've done Toca Tea Party, all of these things. And what Toca Boca does is they make multi-touch versions of toys. Toca Town is, you know, every child plays with toy sets and so on, and makes up toy towns and characters and so on. And this kind of brings that play pattern into the iPad. But it adds a new twist. There's presents you can leave in different rooms, and you can come back and see what they, you know, it's fun to play with another child if you want. But the thing that this one does is it lets you do stuff that you normally, every child wants to do, like clear off the shelf in a grocery store and then put it back in different orders. Or the rules are, you know, there's a kitchen where you can make things and experiment, and you can eat anything you want. You know, it's a place where you can try out a lot of ideas. It's very playful, and there's a lot of sort of accidental learning that'll take place as children play with it.
What do you mean by accidental learning?
Well, I mean, like, there's a row of bottles in this coffee shop, and they're numbered 1 through 9. There's nothing that says, you know, put the bottles in order. There's nothing like that. But children can start to discover that and start to play with the patterns, because the bottles can be stacked or lined up or put on the stage where the musician is. You know, it creates this context where they can discover number relationships. And when they take 8 of the bottles off, they see one's missing, and there's some sort of mental math, quick, you know, really early stuff. But it's because it's really playful and fun, it creates a setting. And then even better, it's one you can play along with your child, so that you can say, okay, I wonder, you know, can I put these back? And maybe we could do it together.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Warren Buchleitner. He's editor of Children's Technology Review, and we're talking about the latest, greatest apps for children. Maybe there's one that you're checking out. Warren might be able to talk to you about it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is there an age range for the Toca Town? You mentioned parents. I mean, adults might like to play with the kid with it. Is that where they might really like to play with it? Or
I think that they list ages 2 and up.
Okay.
Toca Town is the kind of thing, you know, it's two touches and you're into it. You know, so I call these apps accidental success. You really can't fail. And so it'll work with any age. It's kind of, I think, developmentally, you know, it's best for sort of early childhood and early elementary. I kind of like how, you know, what they've sort of gone an extra length to create a diverse cast from every culture and the characters in there, and mm-hmm. lots of styles of music. So there's a lot of sort of informal messages about exploration in this app that are nice.
Cursive Writing Wizard. There's a lot of people are wondering why their kids aren't being taught cursive in school, at least to the extent that a lot of us grew up with.
Right.
And this is a great way to teach cursive. It's a game, right?
Right. Well, I'd like to even back it up another layer to fine motor control, because
okay.
Cursive writing is, you know, every young child, every elementary age child, you know, I used to be an elementary teacher and would teach this to my fourth graders. And, it's you struggle with it. And then later on, calligraphy and you know, there's some worry that the art of the fine motor is being lost because kids are touching and clicking these days. You can kind of use Fight Fire with Fire by having apps where there's challenges and you can develop your fine motor skills. And this is the kind of thing where you could use a stylus. I'm not really an advocate for forcing a child to learn specific, you know, following lines of letters. However, Cursive Writing Wizard also has shapes and different fonts. So you can practice French if you want. This one comes from France, this app. But because it's so customizable and high in child control and fun, it is a great app to have so that a child, even a preschooler, can start to experiment with fine motor, with the fine motor challenges that this app presents. There's a lot of apps like this, but very few that do it as well as Cursive Writing Wizard. And the other one I know we've talked about is called Letter School.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these have all of the mainstream fonts that are used in U.S. schools, like Zahner Bloser, and so on. And you know, so you in Danielian. So you want to have an experience where your children can sort of start getting used to the font that their school is going to use in an early age. So when they see it the first day of school, they're not surprised by it.
And how does it work? I mean, what's the reward system, or how does it? So you're tracing over these shapes or letters, and what do they hear or what do they see?
Yeah, it uses something really old fashioned. It's guided exploration or guided teaching, where it introduces a letter one at a time, and then you master each letter. So your idea is you fill an entire alphabet with stars when you've mastered all the letters, and they're fun because the letters sparkle, and there's random kinds of animations that happen. So if you're with this one, you can adjust the speed of the guide. So younger children could get more help for coaching if they want. Older children who want more of a challenge, you can customize it for them. I always love it when you can customize. And so it's really sort of old-fashioned pedagogy, but the child can control the pace. And it bookmarks. So, you know, you can work on this app for a few months, and it remembers what you've done.
Let's go back to the issue of fine motor development, and why is that important? What are you concerned about as an educator when it comes to that?
Well, I mean, as a sort of, you know, not just as a teacher, as a parent, I mm-hmm. want the next generation to have all forms of control and coordination, both gross motor and fine motor. And the idea that children aren't doing handwriting as much, I think that's a little bit of a myth. In the schools I visit, there's just as much use of pens and pencils and paper as there ever was. But touch screens are more prevalent, and it's a new set of controls. I almost want schools, and I don't think you'll see it yet, but children need to start learning the literacy of screens. So the idea of swiping, pinching, and pulling, and, you know, things like when they see that little Twitter icon or that little Facebook icon, what that means. This is a new type of literacy. So it's a bigger question here, Anne. And I think that as educators and, you know, as the adults these days, we need to start thinking about that our children have the skills they need, both old-fashioned like fine and gross motor, as well as the new kinds of literacies. And the only way they're going to learn that is by being exposed to it with a supportive adult around.
Speaking of adults, there's one called one app called Grandpa in Space.
Right.
Another space app. This one looks like you're helping Grandpa while he works on the space station. Tell us about that, and why do you think the Grandpa character?
Well, this is from Fair Lady Media, mm-hmm. and the woman who makes these has her doctorate in educational psychology. She really knows design, and the previous apps were all grandma apps. I think we may have talked about one before. This time, Grandpa is the star, and they're very sort of these apps have a lot of comical elements to them. So Grandpa goes to space, and in order to make it through the app, or as Grandpa's moving, this time there's real NASA videos embedded. So there's actually a nice side serving of real science in this. And there's all of these skill games that are right out of a school curriculum that are a lot of fun. This is the old take a spoonful of medicine, you know, help a spoonful of sugar helps medicine go down idea. Where, but what I like about it is you can customize it. So you can make it so that children, you know, you can have your children have more, turn this into a language app or more of a math app or that kind of thing. And the dose of science tonight. The whole thing is just overall easy to control and a solid app.
There is one, speaking of literacy and computer literacy, there's one, it's called Tinker, I think. It helps kids learn computer coding, and that's a really big deal, too.
Yeah, it's a huge deal, and the idea that you can turn your tablet now, in this case, the iPad, and I'm seeing these more, I'm waiting for more good Android apps. Google, if you're listening, could you please make Google Play have more good content for kids, because I'm just not finding it yet.
Huh.
Tinker is a terrific, it's inspired from Scratch from MIT. If you haven't downloaded it yet on your laptop, it's just type the word Scratch into Google, and you can, it's free, and it is the best free, and you know, we paid for it with our tax dollars, programming experience. Tinker is sort of a training wheels for Scratch. It's spelled T-Y-N-K-E-R, or tinker.com, and it's free with in-app purchases, and that's the only catch to this one. You learn the first two modules, and then you have to pay up a couple bucks to get the entire version.
And as far as learning computer coding, how does it begin?
Well, you know, this is a question I think should be addressed developmentally, so don't start too young with this.
Okay.
Age 5 and 6 is when children can start playing with the idea, but it's really at about age 7 and 8 where children can start understanding loops and, you know, and get the cool stuff, which is really abstract. Age 10 and 11, that's really the age when they can start enjoying programming, because they have their thinking is developed to the point where they can start to really get the benefits of Scratch, something like Scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tinker makes it so that they can, you know, the challenge is to get a cat, or in this case a dog, I think, to walk down a street. And by counting the squares on the sidewalk, you know, you need 4 squares and then jump to get over a bump. And so this, you start understanding this, it's a pattern of 3 steps plus 1 jump, and 3 steps plus 1 jump will get you to the goal. It's very simple kinds of challenges, and they get harder. So I love these kinds of experiences that sort of grow incrementally with your competency.
Well, I love talking to you, Warren Buchleitner, about these apps. I just wish I had a little kid to try them on. Maybe Amy Jurevich can help us with that. I just got a double thumbs up. Okay, Warren, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and always good to talk with you.
Warren Buchleitner, he's the editor of Children's Technology Review, and he joined us by phone from Pittsburgh. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. A security loophole found in Android phones is creating some unease among users. Samsung is set to launch a new phone, and Microsoft introduces the Surface Pro 3. What does it all mean? Joining us is our regular tech blogger from Geek.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, as always, Russell.
Thank you.
Starting with this loophole, what does it mean for Android phone users? Is it affecting everybody?
No, this is mostly harmless. It's just something that people need to be... It's an example of why we need to pay a little closer attention to some things when using Android phones, or really any mobile phone. You know, we use these really cool tools that allow us to take pictures and do things like that. And there are software rules that are created in the operating system that's really kind of technical stuff that make it so that applications can't use things like the camera without our permission. Android has a really cool way of you know, making sure that that happens. But there was a bypass that was created by a security researcher that basically made it so that it looks like to the operating system the user has given permission to you know take pictures when it hasn't, and it does this by making the viewfinder what you would normally use to see what picture you're taking super small, so that a remote user could take pictures without your permission and then you know kind of upload them and do what they want with them. But that can only happen if your phone has been directly compromised. So like someone would have to take your phone and install this application on it in order for that to happen.
Okay, this is the dumb question. What would a remote user want to take a picture of using my phone?
Well, that's you know, it's any number of situations where you know someone would be directly targeted. So if someone had access to you know sensitive information, or if you just wanted to take pictures in a you know in a specific environment, if you wanted to capture images in a specific environment, then you know this is the kind of thing where you know the remote user could set up a program that basically takes a picture every you know 15 seconds and takes them and you know sends them back to himself in order to you know gain access to whatever environment they're trying to take pictures of. It's not something where every single person needs to look at their phone and freak out, because it's a really specific thing that needs to happen. But it's kind of a lead in to the easy way to make sure that your phone is secure when you're using an Android phone or an iPhone, which is to, you know, to make sure that you're not, that you're paying attention to things like security permissions. Both Android and iPhone, when you go to install an application, the application says, here's the list of things on your phone that we, you know, that we are requesting access to. And it's just important to make sure that, you know, you read that, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, on our desktops where, you know, there used to be those end user license agreements that everyone has always ignored, in the beginning of time. You know, these are a little more, you know, personal. Our smartphones have, you know, tons of personal information on them. So it's important to pay attention to that kind of thing when you're installing those applications.
Read the fine print.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not even fine print for Android. You get a giant pop-up that has big letters. I mean, just read any print, really, would be the, you know, the lesson there. It doesn't even have to be the fine print. Just read the big letters, and it should be okay.
Okay. So you mentioned photos. Are there any other things that this loophole affects yet?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
When you deal with you know kind of remote control stuff, you know, it's stuff like this is really hard for the end user to not notice that something is going on, because you got to figure, if you pick up your phone and you see that you know there are emails being sent, you obviously know that something is up. But if you know for something like the camera, you really only notice when you're inside the camera app or when you're inside your photo gallery or something like that. So it's something that, you know, it's just a little scary to think that kind of thing is possible, but it's really only possible if you are a specific target and you're not paying attention. And at least one of those things you can resolve yourself.
I'm talking with Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a tech question of any stripe, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or we still have time for emails if you want to go that route, at allsides@wosu.org. More on new phones. The fledgling operating system Tizen has found someone who will give them a shot. Samsung is launching a new phone with this system. Why did Tizen have such a hard time finding a carrier in the first place? What is it?
Because it's not Apple or Google.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Originally, Samsung and Intel have both been working on this operating system called Tizen. And it's got some really neat features to it. You know, it's entirely web-based and has some cool visual flourishes that make it look kind of neat. But it's one of those things where, you know, to put it on a phone when it's brand spanking new is hard to sell to somebody when they go, okay, so are there apps for this? And the person, you know, who's holding the phone goes, no, there's not really apps for it yet. You know, and when we live in a world with an iPhone and with countless Android phones, mm-hmm. you know, that's a terrible place to start. Mm-hmm. So Samsung has been working really hard to try and find a partner to sell this phone and to get developer support for a bunch of apps. And they've come a long way from that initial point where they got shut down by a bunch of carriers. And they now have what is called the Samsung Z, which is the first Tizen phone. It's very similar to the Samsung Galaxy S5, but instead of running Android, it is running this new operating system called Tizen. And it's going to be a while before it's available here in the U.S., but it's kind of a start of something new and interesting for Samsung.
So what is the big deal about Tizen? What makes it stand out?
So the big thing that makes it stand out is that it's going to be, you know, hugely customizable on a level that's, is different from what Google and Apple make available. Things, you know, that may seem a little on the trivial side, like, colors that are used throughout the operating system and fonts that are used throughout the operating system, are something that are entirely web-based. And so they can be controlled and edited by the end user. So it ends up being kind of really technical, but the long-term benefit is that it's not directly controlled by either Apple or Google. So, you know, every Android phone has all of Google's apps on them, and there's a bunch of apps that you can't get rid of. And Apple, you know, dictates every single pixel of the Apple experience, whereas Samsung and Intel are going for, you know, a more open and hopefully less metered approach in order to gain attention. And it's not totally clear whether or not this is going to be successful. Samsung has some pretty targeted goals in mind for, you know, what needs to happen in order for Tizen to be successful. But it's a cool new option for people to consider for things, you know, if they're not, you know, happy with Android phones and they're not happy with iPhones, this is kind of a new option that is coming.
What about the Samsung Z phone in general? Is that worth it?
I mean, the hardware is very similar to the Samsung Galaxy S5.
Okay.
The screen isn't quite as nice. It's still a high-definition screen, but it's not quite as high-definition as the Galaxy S5. But it still has a fingerprint sensor and heart rate monitor and a very powerful processor and a very nice camera on the front and back. So, I mean, I haven't messed with one yet, but everything that is on paper for it so far looks really promising.
When you mess with something, what do you do with it?
I have a week-long process that I go through testing a whole bunch of different aspects of a phone or a tablet when I go to mess with something. It is a long and kind of a thoroughly documented process, but it gives me a really good feel for how this phone will work for most people, I think.
So there's like a chart you use?
Yeah, I have a whole document that I go through and kind of take notes and do stuff all throughout the phone, from, you know, how pictures get taken to how fast it responds when, you know, you press the home button, all kinds of things that are probably, small and pedantic to most people. But when I put them all together, it kind of creates a larger picture for how well the phone performs.
Okay. In one of what you actually call geek out sessions on geek.com, you were talking about the Surface Pro 3.
I have spent a ton of time over the last 2 weeks with the Surface Pro 3, and I am very, very happy with it. It is, I can say without reservation, that it is my favorite Windows 8 device right now.
Okay, so what device, what is it, what is the device, first of all?
Well, so Microsoft Surface platform has been trying to, like, float between having a tablet and a laptop in a single device.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, people who have MacBooks and iPads and people who have, you know, Windows tablets and Android tablets and computers, you know, it's kind of frustrating that these devices don't talk to each other quite the way that they should. And so Microsoft has been trying to create this kind of one device. And I like the idea behind the original Surface Pro and the Surface Pro 2, but they were a little bulky and kind of heavy and really just not, the best experience. And Windows took a little while to get to where it is right now with Windows 8.1. So the Surface Pro 3, they made it significantly thinner, significantly lighter. It's now a 12-inch screen instead of a 10-inch screen and has one of the highest resolution displays that you can buy right now in a tablet or laptop form factor, and is just a lot of fun to use. I've been using it a lot. My kids have been using it a lot. It is going to be available starting in August for unless you want one of the Intel Core i5 versions. But it is a full-size laptop as far as, you know, what it's capable of performance-wise, even playing video games. I played a bunch of really high-end games on it and was really happy with the response that I got. And it's you know, it's going to start at $700.
What is the improvements from the last iteration of this then?
The biggest thing is making it so that it's comfortable when you pick it up and walk around with it, which is kind of counterintuitive because it's physically bigger because it's a 12-inch screen instead of a 10-inch screen. But it's so much thinner and lighter that you can pick it up in a corner and, you know, just kind of walk around with it. And it's really comfortable to hold and wander around with. It's also a different aspect ratio, which means that the way that the pixels are aligned are more square and less rectangular. So when you flip from portrait to landscape on the tablet, it doesn't feel quite so awkward.
Is this the one with the ad with the people dancing around the table?
That was one of the original Surface commercials, for the first edition Surface. It's that same concept where it has the keyboard that kind of snaps onto the bottom and the hinge that clips, out and lets you kind of use it as a laptop. And I'm sure that they will have equally crazy commercials for this version of the tablet. But of the three that I have played with from Microsoft and the dozens of other laptops and tablets that I've played with that are running Windows, this is my favorite one right now.
And what did the kids like about it?
The kids really like, that it's something that can sit up in their lap and is comfortable to use and is light. But they also, I have kind of artsy kids that are a big fan of the pen that it comes with. It has an N-Trig pen that allows for kind of stylus-like input and a bunch of apps that allow for drawing right on the tablet or taking notes. There are several applications that will take notes where you write them in your handwriting and it converts them to text that all work really well. And, you know, for them, it's a larger screen to do some of their educational apps on.
Because we're always learning. And you said $700. Is that a good price, in your opinion? Is it worth it?
It's a great price for the base model because it's, you look at the price for laptops right now, that is easily competitive with laptops. Now, they have a whole bunch of different customization options as far as how powerful the processor is, how much storage is. And this model can get, well above $2,000 depending on what you decide to put in it. But I think that for most people looking for an inexpensive laptop or tablet, that the base model would be more than that.
Do you see a day when it's really going to be a merger between tablets and laptops, that they're going to be one and the same?
I absolutely think so. And I was given further evidence to feel that way yesterday when Apple unveiled all the stuff that they unveiled.
Yeah, how so?
The new version of OS X has a ton of visual flourishes from iOS. Apple moved their notification center over. They worked really hard on making it so that the iPhone and MacBooks play well together for a lot of different things, for kind of seamless integration and even sharing phone calls across the device, where a phone rings and you can answer it on your laptop. I think that Apple is moving really, really fast to this kind of seamless experience where, your MacBook and your iPad and your iPhone all are part of the same computing experience. And I think that Microsoft is heading in that same direction.
Okay. Are we heading in a direction where you want everything to be either, Android, Microsoft, or Apple?
I'm sure that these companies want that. I will say that Google works really hard, at the very least, with Apple products to make sure that their apps, run on all of the Apple stuff the same way that it runs on all the Google stuff. So it's not, a complete lock-in experience.
Uh-huh.
You're not forced to use an Android tablet or a Chromebook in order to get all these experiences. You can use an iPad and you can use a MacBook and you can use an Android phone, which is, my setup most of the time. And so that ends up being a lot of the same experience there.
Okay. All right, Russell Holley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, tech blogger for geek.com. That's all the time we have for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.